we'll meet an ambassador for poetry today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Rebecca Wee.
And I'm Don Wooten. What does an Iowa poetry ambassador do? We'll ask one, Lola Nakashima Brook, on Scribble. Last time I met an ambassador... It was a Belgian consul.
Well,
I know you raise your eyes there, but we used to have one in Moline.
Seriously?
Yeah. She was here permanently and ran a gift shop.
Oh, my.
Yeah, the Flemish Lion. It was wonderful. I would shop there at least every Christmas Eve. But Lola, congratulations.
Thank you.
How did you become an ambassador? I mean, did you volunteer? Did they vote or what?
It's a strange process. It's not always strange, but it's not one that many people know about because it's a relatively new thing. So the way I got into it was because I do stuff with the Midwest Writing Center, and they are sort of part of Iowa City Poetry, and the original way that they would submit poets for this program was that they'd talk to the Scholastic Foundation, but then after a few years, they started branching out more to other poetry organizations in the state to see if they could get, like, other young poets, mm-hmm. and that's how they found me.
That's how they found you.
That's mm-hmm. how they found you. And where did they find you? Where are you from?
I'm from Davenport.
You are Davenport.
Yeah, I was born and raised there, but I do the Midwest Writing Center's youth summer internship.
Okay.
I've done it for the past 2 years, now I'm going to do it this year. But it's based here in Rock Island, usually at the library.
Yep.
And yeah, we get together like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, 5:30 to 7:30. And we just basically write all the time. And by the end of it, we have like a full magazine ready to go.
Whoa.
How did you happen to move into poetry? Was it an accident? Or was it purposeful? What happened?
I'd say it was both kind of an accident and purposeful because I hadn't done a lot of poetry before. You know, I did like the little rhyming stuff that I was like, this feels too much like a nursery rhyme. But
hey, there's nothing wrong with nursery rhymes.
No, I know that now. Those are the
poetry.
Best kinds of poetry right there. But I was writing more just like fiction and stuff like that. And my mom, it was right after the COVID year. So she was like, okay, you need to get out more. So she found a friend of hers found this thing and she was like, you should do this. And I was like, okay, I can do poetry more. And because of that internship, I just started writing like all sorts of poetry and I learned to experiment with it.
Uh huh.
Were you working then with Ryan Collins?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hands-on with a lot of stuff through the Midwest Writing Center.
Yeah, in the internship, he's always a huge help, along with Sarah. They make sure that you feel welcome, that you can really just share anything that you've written.
Like, they have a big
graces.
Thing coming up in June, don't they, a conference?
Yeah, we have the David R. Collins Writing Conference, I think. I think that's it.
That's
I
it.
Probably should look that up, but yeah.
No, you got it right.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's turned into quite an operation, hasn't it?
It has.
It's a big thing.
Yep. In the years since I came to Augustana, it's changed a lot and grown enormously, and it's wonderful.
Yeah. Are there many poets involved in that, or are they mostly writers?
I'd say it's a mix of the two. Like in the internship that I do, we get like free passage and tickets to go there and take part in the workshops that they do. And they've just got all sorts of writers there.
Yeah.
Like, it's a whole, like, melting pot of writing.
Yeah.
When did you first start writing poetry?
Probably around when I was in middle school or elementary school. But, when I started writing more seriously with it, I'd say probably freshman year of high school.
Okay.
And what do you mean by seriously?
Like, I started dedicating more time to it and actually trying to create stuff that I'd be proud of.
And was that through a class, or that was just you loving it?
I took a creative writing class mm-hmm. when I was in eighth grade at the Creative Arts Academy.
Okay.
And, you know, I think it was then that I started doing more serious poetry stuff, but I didn't, like, sort of delve into it until freshman year.
Yeah. All right. Uh-huh.
Well, it's amazing, you know, that you have received such recognition so early. But what exactly does a poetry ambassador do? Do you wear a sash?
I kind of hope I do. Yeah, I kind of hope I get a nice little sash. That'd be nice. But it's a relatively new position. So when I was sort of inducted into it, they were like, okay, you're like the third ever. So you sort of just get to make it your own thing. Mm-hmm. Like, I know the previous Iowa Student Poetry Ambassador, Johnny Each, I think she focused more on environmental stuff. And I said that I wanted to help, like, get poetry more into schools.
Okay. Do you move around? Do you stay here?
I mean, I had to move around a lot a couple weeks ago when I had to go to the Capitol, mm-hmm. which I'd never actually been to before. But, I mean, some of it I get to do virtually. Like, I get to do virtual meets for, like, I think it's the All Iowa Reads.
Okay.
But sometimes I do have to go places, like, throughout the state.
Yeah. Everything is getting to be virtual, isn't it?
I mean, it was forced to be virtual for a while, yeah. And then people were sort of glad to get back in public, but we discovered that we could do things virtually, and that's been sometimes
Sometimes it's good, yeah, because you can get people in no matter where they are,
yep.
But I do like when things are in person as well, because there's a more personal level to it.
Yeah. I'm a fanatic for personal contact. I look at my computer with admiration and loathing.
It's a machine.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, it's just, you know, it commands too much attention these days, I think. Although my relationship with the iPhone is much better. I just keep it in my hip pocket turned off.
That's the way to do it.
So let's see. Do you get to work with staff? Can you have people help you with whatever it is you're organizing in this position, or is it all on you?
I'm really thankful that it is not all on me,
yeah.
Because I've got way too much stuff on my shoulders just to be doing all that,
sure.
Especially because I've got senior year coming up.
Yeah.
But Jan Warren, who works at the University of Iowa, she's been a great help with it. Like, I'll send her emails and I'll be like, hey, do I get to do this? What's up with this? And she'll be like, oh, yeah, she'll give me all the information. Yeah, I get lots of help, and I'm really thankful for that.
That's good.
Is she kind of managing your operation?
Basically, yeah. Because I'm still, like, a minor, I can't do, like, everything all on my own.
Yeah.
So they have her there basically just to help guide me through it and set stuff up.
Uh-huh. So if they suddenly call you and say, we'd like to have you come to Sioux City for a meeting.
Oh, man, I'd have to say, oh, yeah, I have to put you through Jan. Yeah, I wish I could say yes right now, but you got to talk to her first.
Yeah. Oh, dear, the obligations of office, I must say.
Yeah.
Well, so have you been doing readings? Is that part of what you're required to do, is travel places and read?
Mm-hmm. I haven't done any readings yet because I basically just got it, but I've got some set up throughout the year that are sort of like the mandatory stuff that they give the poetry ambassador. But like throughout, as the year goes on, if they want me to do more readings, just like certain poetry organizations, if they ask and it's accepted, then I can go do those too.
Okay.
Well, we'd like you to do some reading too.
All right.
How many poems have you written? Do you keep count?
Oh, I really wish I did. I don't know how much. It'd be difficult to consider, because some of the stuff I just keep in, like, little notebooks. I don't really consider them, like, poems. They're just, like, little starts to stuff. And then I have, like, stuff on my computer that I write, and sometimes I consider those poems, but I don't know. It'd be better just to do, like, a word count of how much of the stuff I'd written.
Well, I hear that. And if you're keeping notebooks, you mm-hmm. often are just kind of, oh, I want to remember that.
Yeah.
So I'm going to take a note here, and you may or may not get back to them.
It's like, January 3rd, I saw this.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
You'll notice that Rebecca has a pen in her hand.
Oh.
She is never without it.
I can't think without a pen.
I kind of
can't talk even very clearly if I don't. I do it in class, too, when I'm teaching. I have to have a pen.
We'll be going along, and all of a sudden she starts writing it, I think. What was just
What was that? No, it's just notes to self.
Yeah,
you know?
I like pens better than pencils sometimes.
Yeah,
Read some of your poems for us, will you?
All right, I've got one that I thought was like, oh, this one's kind of dismal and sad. But, I mean, there was just a shooting in Allen, Texas, so thought it's a poem about gun violence.
Read it slowly so I can follow you.
It's all right. I got you. Okay. It doesn't have a title yet because if there's anything poets are really bad at, it's titling their work. Uh-huh. Either comes right away or you spend like months not having a title.
Yep.
All right. I think the worst thing about gun violence in this country is the fact that I don't feel anything anymore. The correct term for it would be desensitization. And even though people have mixed feelings on definition poetry, the word desensitization is a psychological term. It's a treatment or process in which emotional responses are diminished to negative, positive, or aversive emotional stimulus after repeated exposure. I've written about gun violence before, but that was when I still felt any kind of emotion towards what was happening. See, video games and movies don't desensitize me towards cannibalism and drug use and prejudice. If anything, it made me hyper-aware. Guns? I used to feel sad and awful and angry that I could walk into a supermarket, my own house, go to a concert, see a movie, go to church for once, and get shot. You know what the worst part was? I'm the lucky one. I've never watched kids bleed out and die, and I've never been shot. I just get to worry. To think, what if he has a gun? And now I'll be looking through news articles, see shooting in blank, blank killed, blank wounded, and I don't feel anything. I react to it the same way I react to, in Bahamas, conch fishing is a way of life. But for how long? Patrick Whittle, AP News. I don't feel anything. Apathy. Because I'm already on a roll with citations here, let me explain my point of view with a quote from my favorite video game, the 2004 game Knights of the Old Republic 2, where Kreia says, apathy is death. Worse than death, because at least a rotting corpse feeds the beasts and insects. American public school is apathy. It's school shooter jokes and bomb threats and a lockdown every so often to keep you on your toes. You don't feel anything. If I do feel anything, it's confusion when people ask me, why would you want to leave America? Why the fuck do you think? Kim Reynolds made it legal to carry a handgun without a permit. Mind you that news stations reported her considering this a couple weeks after 10 people were shot and killed in Boulder. 2021, if you, like me, forgot. I feel like it's useless to say how many more, because no one else is listening. I mean, it's a good question. Who has to die for things to change? Do I have to get shot? My brother and sister? My cousins? My classmates? My friends? What has to happen? Do your kids have to get shot? What do I have to do? What do you want? When will the suffering be enough? Does someone have to come up and shoot up Congress for you to understand the terror that people hear that I live through daily? Or will you wipe it from your mind when the NRA pays you $1,000 for each man dead? When will it be enough for you? For a second, my own apathy dissipates and I feel like throwing up. But give me 10 minutes or 10 seconds and it'll be gone. I'll be no different than dead.
Wow. I must say, just another shooting. You know, it's almost monotonous. Shootings every week. Yeah. At least one. At least one mass shooting every week.
Yeah, that's the thing.
And
I wanted to write about that.
More.
Well, and I wonder about those of you who had to grow up having drills for, you know, an active shooter in the school. We had tornado drills, but there's a whole different, you're trying to stay alive, but you aren't up against something or someone with ill intent. And, you know, I don't know. You can't keep being panicked all the time, and yet you can't pretend you don't know what you know.
Yeah. So a majority of people want some control over this, but a minority controls the whole situation.
Mm-hmm.
And money talks.
Yeah,
it does.
Of course.
What is it Shakespeare says, though it have no tongue, yet will money speak with most miraculous organ?
Yeah.
Ooh, and it's true, money talks.
Yeah.
And the armament industry wants to make money. People have invested in it.
Mm-hmm.
And they need more people to. We have more guns, far more guns than people in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And you think, when is enough?
Yeah.
And are you kidding me? Assault rifles?
I know.
Who needs that?
You really don't. I don't see the point in it. See, I mean, I'm at the point where I'm not even asking for just like, you know, we take away all the guns or any kind of radical change. Just even symbolic change would be enough at this point, because I, like you said, I had like school shooter drills growing up, and it didn't really hit me like that why we were having this until I got older and things just started getting progressively worse.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, I used to get so angry about it, and I wrote about how angry I was about that. And now I just, like, I was, like, so horrified at my own apathy to it that I had to write that down because I didn't entirely understand it.
You know what's interesting to me, though, is that what you're experiencing as apathy, the minute it takes shape in a poem, it's something more than that. Even if you're recognizing and addressing, I don't know how to keep responding to this, that I think... that's what poets do, is try to find language for things we don't have language for.
Especially when you're just trying to explain something through writing and you end up realizing it while you're writing it. That's a good thing with poetry, because when you're trying to explain something or document some kind of reaction or emotional story that you've had, and you end up discovering something about yourself or realizing something while you're writing that, that's a good thing that comes with poetry.
Yep.
Well, what are you going to do? You know, it's not, I don't know what you call it, apathy, but it's just, it's become so common.
Yeah.
And the real difficulty, let me get up on the dais here and give my lecture. The real problem is that these things happen to other people.
Yeah.
And we are so insular that unless it happens to us, we're not passionate about it.
Which is one of the lines that you had there.
Yeah.
Was kind of, does it have to happen to my brother, to me, to...
That's right. Unless it happens to you, people say global warming is a hoax.
Yeah.
Unless a tornado hits their house.
Yeah.
And then, well, my viewpoint has changed. But it's, once you adopt a position, it's so hard to change.
Yep.
It really is. We are not accustomed to that. And yet, change is what life is all about.
Well, and that's, I think, one of the reasons that, you know, you kind of set this up as, oh, no, this is going to be kind of depressing. But I think that one of the reasons that lots of poems are, my students say that, too. It's too, I don't want to read this. It's too depressing.
Yeah.
And I think, no, that's what we have to talk about. And we are working it out when you sit down to write it into a poem. We can write happy poems. Those are good, too.
I like writing happy stuff.
But they maybe aren't as urgent somehow.
Do you write happy poems?
I've written a few happy poems, yeah. My dad was like, he would go to stuff that I'd read, and he was like, why is everybody writing about all this sad stuff? And I'm like, I don't know. We're all a bunch of, like, adolescents. We're kind of focused on that one thing.
Do you have any other poems in your poem?
I have a happy one if you guys want to hear that.
Oh, yes. One. Sure.
Let's just turn up the lights here.
So I teach at Augustana College, and my students always, if creative writing are... That's sort of their, they want to write happy poems and then they fail terribly. Then they go say, nope, got to go back to the dark stuff.
Well, I think, you know, it's, poetry is an intellectual operation, but the emotions ride on it.
Yeah.
And it's the things that move you.
Yeah.
That prompt you to write poetry.
This is sort of about something that moved me and made me just, like, very happy. I went to London with my marching band a couple months ago, but we got to ride on the train a lot, and I really like riding on trains.
Yeah.
So I wrote this about it. It sort of went through a lot of development. There is an incredibly romantic aspect to riding the train. I reacted to it the same way I reacted to glitter highlighter. I wanted to use it all the time. It is hot and stuffy, and you want to let go of your pole to go tumbling back into people in puffy coats just to feel someone's arms around you. But I like it. I was always very good at being quiet. I just think while I'm on the train. I invent songs from the drum beats of the train hitting the track going faster and faster and faster. I feel like I am everything on the train. I am myself and the people around me, their souls bleeding into mine when they shove me trying to stay steady as the train starts moving again. It's funny watching people shift and wave like grass as the train screeches and stops. Part of me wishes I'd brought earbuds to listen, to watch people move in time with the beat in my head. Sometimes it is lonely, people watching on tartan seats, but really, it is hard to feel lonely surrounded by people. I hear dialogue from passerby, from debating sisters, unruly boys, uptight fathers, and a mother doting on her son, a mother who's noting her son is crying, is because he just wants to hold the appealing yellow pole my hand rests on. I don't even think, I just move half a foot so his little hand can worm through the crowd of people and hold on to the pole. It's half the size of mine. His mother calls him Jensen, and the man who's been complaining the whole ride about how many people there are smiles at the boy and calls him son. His mother smiles and thanks me, and I can't even bring myself to reciprocate because I'm so taken aback. I don't remember her face now. I remember her smile. I remember how much she loved her son. I could see it on her face. I remember the little boy. I don't really remember why I moved. I just did. Because he was so little, and he was crying so loud, and he was so little. I just moved. He gets off at Holborn. The train is the greatest thing in the world to me, because it's been 4 months since I saw Jensen and Co., and every time I think about them, someone ends up asking me, "What are you smiling about?"
Oh, wonderful. That's terrific. Oh, I love the places that went.
Yeah.
That was actually the Tube, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The London Tube is really something.
It's something. It's a strange place, but I love it down there.
Oh, yeah. It just amazes me how you can move around London that way.
Mm-hmm.
We used to take station trips for about 8 to 10 years. I can't remember now.
Mm.
But I used to go on them, and my goodness, what a wonderful place it is.
Yep.
All the England has pillaged the world and brought all the treasures to London.
Yeah.
I love how you started that one by comparing using the train to having discovered glitter highlighter.
Yeah.
You know, and then you discover that and you want it only that all the time. But I would never think to compare those two mm-hmm. things. So now I have a new association from having listened to that. It's very nice.
We have a little time left. Do you have another poem you want to read?
Oh, let's see. This one's also a little depressing, but I mean,
it's okay.
Yeah, it's okay. It's important. So, I mean,
it is.
Yeah.
Yep.
I read this one, I want to say, a week ago at the Love Girls Awards, which was in Bettendorf, I think.
Okay.
But I wrote it about the internment of Japanese Americans during mm-hmm. World War II, because there's a lot of strange coincidences with like media and stuff and books about the internment that all happened sort of all at once a couple months ago. And I was like, oh, this is too weird. I gotta write about this.
Okay.
Yeah. But all right. Battle of the Books this year, we argue over books about the internment by Tracy Chi. The title is a little too on the nail, and I stare at the cover for a moment. We are not free. It is a question of heritage, the words behind barbed wire held in my throat. Grandpa Vic and Uncle George got out. My mom wonders aloud how awful it would have been for him, a Japanese doctor, a man with the face of an enemy, trying to treat American soldiers. I wonder if he ever saw his homeland, a place across the ocean, the wasteland left behind. Where is the sacrifice in being told to enlist, in healing, loving the people who condemn you, being forced to watch your mother and father's country burn as a stick of incense to ash? But what choice do you have? What choice do they give you? What choice do you have left? Books splayed out with peering colors, we have to write an essay this time. Pick one. I choose Snow Falling on Cedars, about Japanese internment. Does it have to be written by a white guy? All right, the character is white. Aloquis. Why am I picking it anyway? I could reread Bel Canto. My essay would be done in seconds. I remember reading the articles years ago, tasting the blood in my mouth, smelling iron when I saw they put children in cages at the border. But I wasn't all that surprised. This government has always liked barbed wire. Maybe it's stupid, maybe it's overreacting, but my friends always joke about why I distrust the government. But if I've learned anything, it's that if you think the government wouldn't do something that horrible, they already have. When I was very young, young enough that memories blurred and burned, singed on the edges, my mother buys So Far From the Sea by Eve Bunting. She is crying when she reads it to me. I don't understand why. It sits on the shelf next to the book on Manzanar. My family was at Minidoka. Does it matter? Why chase the history? My great-grandpa Vic was Nisei. Grandpa Jimmy was Sansei. My mom and my uncle Michael are Yonsei. Does this make me Gosei? Or am I just American at this point? Grandpa Vic was.
You know, that's very good. I remember when that happened.
You do?
And I thought that was just terrible.
Yeah.
I said, if that's the case, why don't you lock up all the German Americans?
Mm-hmm.
Because we're fighting Germany. Yeah. You know, why don't you lock up all the Italian Americans? Because we're fighting Italy.
Mm-hmm.
Why
mm-hmm.
pick on the Japanese? But there's that deep prejudice along the West Coast that goes way back. It's as bad as the Southern prejudice against blacks.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy. Yeah. But we're crazy
sometimes. Sometimes we're just a little crazy.
I'm kind of struck by that line about, this government has always liked barbed wire.
Yeah.
You know, she's got lines like that just,
Yeah, it's an interesting thing to deal with government. I was in it for a while, and to see how things operate and what the pressures are to do and not do. And how hard it is to get something done that really is, how can I put it, useful?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Benefits individuals and so on. It's so hard to do because, once again, money is the main concern. And until we can get past that, and we never will, I don't know that anything will change significantly.
Mm-hmm. But poetry is a good way to take it on.
We always have poetry.
Yep. It's an act of
rebellion.
Really is.
You two have poetry. What have I got?
Oh, you got, think about it.
You got the radio.
All the different things you've done.
Yeah, but poetry, I've tried it, and I'm not very good at it.
Well, the problem for poetry always is that not enough people read it. The people who need to read it most probably are the ones who are not interested.
I mean, if we're talking about acts of rebellion, think about how radio has been used.
Yeah.
Well, you know, do you look back on your poetry with great satisfaction?
I mean, some of it, I'll look back on the stuff that I wrote when I was like 11 and 12, and I'll be like, ugh.
Yeah, I was
going through some things, I see. But, I mean, most of it I do look back on with a bit of pride. Even if I don't really like it, I'm like, that needed some work. I'll just take pride in the fact that I wrote it down, that I took the courage to just be like, you know what, I'm going to write this.
That's kind of evidence of who you were at that point in time, and we have to honor that. But all writers do that, right?
Yeah.
They look back at their juvenilia and go, oh, no.
I know people will just look back at our stuff and be like, I'll be like, oh, this is so great. And I'm like, oh, no, it's not.
Well, that's, you know, once it's in print, you're stuck.
Yeah,
print
it's true.
Never dies. Lola, I am so delighted that you spent time with us today.
I'm glad to be here.
And I am impressed. I am meeting an ambassador for poetry, and that means it's Rebecca, that's something you can aspire to.
Yes. I think you're old.
But for right now, we're out of time. Our guest has been Lola Nakashimi Brook, the Iowa Ambassador for Poetry. We'll see you next week on the next edition of Scribble.